It was a welcome change for President Kennedy, talking not about another crisis, talking not about the risk we must face in the age of the bomb. It was a welcome change to talk to astronauts and to the nation and the world about our country's accomplishments in outer space. But in less than 2 months, on April 11, 1962, there was another crisis. This one, though, on the home front, and its name was steel. The issue, an unexpected price rise. The action? Listen.
The simultaneous and identical actions of United States Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable and irresponsible defiance of the public interest. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are examining the significance of this action in a free, competitive economy. The Department of Defense and other agencies are reviewing its impact on their policies of procurement. And I am informed that steps are underway by those members of the Congress who plan appropriate inquiries into how these price decisions are so quickly made and reached, and what legislative safeguards may be needed to protect the public interest. Price and wage decisions in this country, except for a very limited restrictions in the case of monopolies and national emergency strikes, are and ought to be freely and privately made. But the American people have a right to expect, in return for that freedom, a higher sense of business responsibility for the welfare of their country than has been shown in the last 2 days. Some time ago, I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country, and I asked the steel company. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer.
That's what President Kennedy said, and this is what Roger M. Blau, the president of U.S. Steel, answered on the very next day.
When the president of the United States speaks, as he did yesterday, regarding our corporation and its cost price problems, I'm sure a response is indicated and desirable. Let me say respectfully that we have no wish to add to acrimony or to misunderstanding. We do not question the sincerity of anyone who disagrees with the action we have taken. Neither do we believe that anyone can properly assume that we are less deeply concerned with the welfare, the strength, and the vitality of this nation than are those who have criticized our actions. As employees and stockholders, we, along with thousands of other employees and stockholders, both union and non-union, must discharge faithfully our responsibilities to United States Steel. But as citizens, we must also discharge fully our responsibilities to the nation. The action we have taken is designed to meet both those responsibilities.
Why so swift and so severe a crackdown? The President of the United States told why in a conversation with three network newscasters, NBC's Sander Vanocur among them, in a December 17th conversation.
I think it would have been a serious situation if I had not attempted with all my influence to try to get a rollback, because there was an issue of good faith involved. The steel union had accepted the most limited settlement that they had had since the end of the Second War. They had accepted it 3 or 4 months ahead. They did it in part, I think, because I said that we could not afford another inflationary spiral that would affect our competitive position abroad. So they signed up. And then when their last contract was signed, which was the Friday or Saturday before, then steel put its prices up immediately. Well, it seemed to me that that was the question of good faith was involved. And that if I had not attempted, after asking the unions to accept a non-inflationary settlement, if I hadn't attempted to use my influence to have the companies hold their prices stable, I think the unions could have rightfully felt that they had been misled. In my opinion, it would have endangered the whole bargaining between labor and management would have made it impossible for us to exert any influence from the public point of view in the future on these great labor management disputes which do affect the public interest. So I have no regrets. The fact is we were successful. Now, supposing we had tried and made a speech about it and then failed, I would have thought that would have been an awful setback to the office of the presidency.
Throughout his 2 years and 10 months as President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy showed his interest in the youth of America, in the youth of the world. He saw in them perhaps the hope of humanity, the hope that the word peace would mean just that, peace, peace for all, peace everywhere, peace in the survival of man. Look back at his accomplishments while in office, and everywhere there is youth. Even on the White House lawn as he welcomes 2,000 foreign exchange students to the United States of America.
I want to welcome you to the White House. I'm afraid I had understood that we had 2,000 foreign students, but I'm afraid that your year's stay in the United States has made you at least on the surface look like 2,000 Americans. Whether that's a good thing or not, only time will tell. So we're glad to have you here.
But just as there was joy in welcoming the cream of the world's youth to America, so too there was sadness in honoring the memory of American men who lost their lives on foreign shores, men who made the supreme sacrifice so that all other men could remain free. The President salutes them in his State of the Union message on the 14th of January of the year that also marked his own violent death, 1963.
I think these are proud and memorable days in the cause of peace and freedom. We are proud, for example, of Major Rudolph Anderson, who gave his life over the island of Cuba. We salute Specialist James Allen Johnson, who died on the border of South Korea. We pay honor to Sergeant Gerald Pendle, who was killed in Vietnam. They are among the many who in this century, far from home, have died for our country. Our task now, and the task of all Americans, is to live up to their commitment.
In the first two-thirds of the year 1962, the nation moved along on an even keel, free of crisis, if you can accept such things as the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. Attention was focused mainly on domestic affairs, medical care for the aged, a farm bill, taxes, the budget, and a healthy economy. There were no crises to speak of in those first 8 or 9 months of 1962, but then, suddenly, swiftly, another crisis on the home front. This one on a college campus in Mississippi. An American named Meredith wanted to go to classes there, but it became necessary for the President of the United States to speak directly to the people of that state, Mississippi, and he said this.
You have a new opportunity to show that you are men of patriotism and integrity. For the most effective means of upholding the law is not the state policeman or the marshals or the National Guard. It is you. It lies in your courage to accept those laws with which you disagree as well as those with which you agree. The eyes of the nation and all the world are upon you and upon all of us. And the honor of your university and state are in the balance. I am certain the great majority of the students will uphold that honor. There is, in short, no reason why the books on this case cannot now be quickly and quietly closed in the manner directed by the court. Let us preserve both the law and the peace. And then, healing those wounds that are within, we can turn to the greater crises that are without and stand united as one people in our pledge to man's freedom.
That was on September the 30th, 1962, a domestic crisis. But then it was October the 22nd, 1962, and there was a much broader crisis, a crisis that easily might have meant the end of all mankind. The buildup of Soviet missiles in Cuba, only 90 miles away from the United States shores, and pointed at the heart of our country. But President Kennedy was up to this crisis, too, very much up to it. So in spite of all the risk involved, he took seven steps, the most important of which were these.
Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. The foreign ministers of the OAS, in their communique of October 6, rejected secrecy on such matters in this hemisphere. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities, and I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Yes, the President of the United States was up to what the world came to know as the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the chest of every American swelled with pride, because the voice of the man who had spoken the "we're ready to take the consequences" words was their spokesman, our spokesman, the voice of America, the conscience and courage of America. And then it was December, and just about the end of two crisis-riddled years in the presidency. A newsman asked him what those 2 years had been like. What was his reaction?
I would say that the problems are more difficult than I imagined them to be. The responsibilities placed in the United States are greater than I imagined them to be, and there are greater limitations upon our ability to bring about a favorable result than I had imagined them to be. And I think that's probably true of anyone who becomes president, because there is such a difference between those who advise or speak or legislate and between the man who must select from the various alternatives proposed and say that this shall be the policy of the United States. Well, it's much easier to make the speeches than it is to finally make the judgments.
And then newsman asked John F. Kennedy about the perils of nuclear war.
Once he fires his missiles, it's all over anyway, because we're going to have sufficient resources to fire back at him to destroy the Soviet Union. When that day comes, and there's a massive exchange, then that's the end for... Because you're talking about Western Europe, Soviet Union, the United States, of 150 million fatalities in the first 18 hours. So that the nuclear age is a very dangerous period, and that's why I frequently read these speeches about how we must do this and that, but I think they ought to just look at what we're talking about.
Reporters got slightly less global in their questioning. They asked the president only about Berlin.
Berlin is a dangerous position always, particularly because of its geography, because we have to keep communications to an area which is 120 miles behind their lines. So this always gives him a chance to tighten the grip on our windpipe there. But I think he may proceed with some care, because I think he realizes it's a combination of a vital interest and one which has the chance of a direct encounter. So that I think that, as I say, Mr. Khrushchev's speech showed that he knows, and those who are attacking Mr. Khrushchev in the communist camp, particularly the Chinese, as being too soft, I think Mr. Khrushchev realizes the care with which he must proceed now, as do we.
The reporters weren't finished with their questions. They seldom are. They always have just one more to ask. Several years ago, while John F. Kennedy was still a senator, his father had asked him why he wanted to be the President of the United States. And he had replied quite matter-of-factly that he considered himself the best man for the job. And so now, at this roundtable conversation in December of 1962, a newsman asked him roughly the same question.
Yes, I think the presidency, there's a lot of satisfactions to the presidency, because particularly, if, as I say, we're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which, if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction. When, as a result of a decision of yours, a failure comes or you're unsuccessful, of course that's a great setback. But I must say, after being here for 2 years and having the experience of the presidency, and there's no experience you can get that can possibly prepare you adequately for the presidency, I must say that I have a good deal of hope for the United States, just because I think that this country, which is, as I say, criticized itself and has criticized around the world 180 million people for 17 years, really for more than that, for almost 20 years, have been the great means of defending first the world against the Nazi threat, and since then against the communist threat. And if it weren't for us, the communists would be dominant in the world today, and because of us, we're in a strong position. Now, I think that's a pretty good record for a country with 6% of the world's population, which is very reluctant to take on these burdens. I think we ought to be rather pleased with ourselves this Christmas.
And then it was January 14th, 1963, and President John Fitzgerald Kennedy delivered his third and final State of the Union message to the Congress of the United States and to all of its people, and also to all of the people of the world. And he spoke about the disarray of the left. He spoke about democracy versus communism.
New nations asked to choose between two competing systems need only compare conditions in East and West Germany, Eastern and Western Europe, North and South Vietnam. They need only compare the disillusionment of communist Cuba with the promise of a hemisphere alliance for progress. And all the world knows that no successful system builds a wall to keep its people in and freedom out. And the wall dividing Berlin is a symbol of that communist failure.
On the domestic scene, there was one accomplishment of President Kennedy's that stood out above all others, a home front accomplishment that will earn him a permanent place and an honorable place in the history of our nation. That accomplishment, of course, was in the field of human rights, the inalienable right of all Americans to be treated equally because they are equal, and no state and no governor can rule it otherwise. There were many presidents who came between Kennedy and Lincoln. 100 years is a long time. But John F. Kennedy did as much, did more, for the Negroes in his 2 years and 10 months of office than did all the other presidents combined. He did it, too, in the typically Kennedy manner, which stated simply is this: when action is called for, act, and when speech is called for, speak. Listen to him as he speaks on June the 11th, 1963. Soft but strong words brought on by the events in Alabama.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
By the time the president made that speech, he had reached a spiritual point of no return. Earlier, during a speech at Vanderbilt University, Mr. Kennedy had endorsed the right of Negroes to defy local segregation laws. He had characterized it as being consistent with the highest traditions of American freedom. Richard Revere, an author and the Washington correspondent for the New Yorker magazine, followed that particular development of the president's civil rights stance very closely.
What struck me as unique historically was that the leader of a society, the President of the United States, was lending his prestige and support to what seemed to me to be a resistance movement. And it seemed clearer and clearer as the months went on that a resistance movement is what it was. I personally was very thankful that he did do that, but it nevertheless seemed to me quite remarkable and historically certainly unique.
Was the president ahead of the country at that point? It's a question that social scientists pondered. One of them was Dr. Eric Goldman, Rollins Professor of History at Princeton University.
To me, the really important thing about the relationship of the late president and civil rights is the fact that he himself went about the matter somewhat cautiously, waiting for what he called a consensus to form in the United States. That is, he himself did not realize just how far the revolution was going or with what speed. And therefore, when he himself felt it necessary to move, as he did in that famous speech of last June, it meant that this very shrewd student of American public opinion and American life felt that some kind of a consensus there did exist on which he could base a real civil rights policy. I was particularly struck that when he did move, he went rather far, as has been commented upon by Richard Revere, actually not approving, but in a sense condoning of the use of, if not force, threats of force on the part of the Negro. I suspect that in history, Mr. Kennedy's place will be more determined by this particular set of actions with respect to civil rights than anything else. And in this, he will be considered a man who sensed very clearly and very accurately where things were going and at what speed, and who also had the vigor to move on them.
One historian, Gerald W. Johnson of Baltimore, believes that Negro concern for civil rights helped push President Kennedy into his bold stance.
He is the first president during whose administrations the Negroes demanded civil rights. Abraham Lincoln was interested in their freedom, but at that time they had no Negro leadership. It's only during the recent years that the Negroes have really made a demand for civil rights. So Kennedy naturally was the first president who has concerned himself seriously with that.
Historian Henry Steele Cominger believes that perhaps President Kennedy and history itself exploited each other.
Circumstances not only played into his hand, but perhaps forced his hand here. He was fortunate in that he could count on a far more enlightened and activist public opinion than any of his predecessors. But it was more than good fortune. Here he himself took a leadership that none of his predecessors had seized and dramatized the civil rights issue as no other president had dramatized it, helped carry it forward to solution, not to ultimate solution, for there are no ultimate solutions in matters of this kind, but helped improve the situation, helped give a sense of courage and of confidence and hope to the Negro and to the friends of the Negro in all parts of the country that the long disgrace of second-class citizenship was drawing to an end.
We can't help but wonder what moved the president to action. Was this cool, sometimes impassive-seeming young New Englander acting in the tradition of earlier New Englanders, abolitionists? Or was he simply going about what he felt was his public obligation? Dr. Goldman.
I've never been able to determine in my own mind the extent to which Mr. Kennedy or his brother, the Attorney General, sensed the moral issue, which to persons like myself is implicit in this matter. I don't think it really makes much difference. I think he was thinking in terms that at least had larger moral implications. That is, the holding together of the American people, the holding together of the context and structure of our society. Whether he sensed the moral issue in the sense that Martin Luther King talks about it, I don't know.
Here is the Reverend Martin Luther King with his evaluation.
President Kennedy was a friend of civil rights. There can be no gainsaying of the fact that he created a climate of civil rights concern and sought at many points to subpoena the conscience of the nation, to appear before the judgment seat of morality on this very basic moral issue. And I think this is a great loss.
Richard Revere believes the president was motivated in his concern for civil rights by two things.
The president had a clear moral position on this essentially moral issue, and he also, of course, saw the political necessities of it. The job of a leader of any society is to, in the first place, to keep the society from falling apart, and this was a direct threat to the whole fabric of American society. As to passion, I don't think passion is the word one applied to John Kennedy, but conviction certainly.
Some historians find a clear parallel between the actions of President Kennedy and those of Abraham Lincoln, holding the Union together. Dr. Goldman.
As we all know, Lincoln, faced with a similar issue, said the basic problem is to preserve the Union. I will vote slavery up or down in order to do that. I think the basic problem to Mr. Kennedy was to preserve the fabric of American society, and he was for, or not against, but for speedy action on civil rights or slower action on civil rights, depending upon that criterion.
We put some more questions to Mr. Revere. One of them, was President Kennedy the first president with an unqualified stand on civil rights?
Kennedy was a liberal president, and the first Democratic liberal in this century was Woodrow Wilson, who did not share anything like Kennedy's view. Wilson was a more or less typical Southerner, and a good deal of segregation actually began under Wilson. Roosevelt was committed to economic opportunities for the Negro and certainly against discrimination, but his conscience was not, so far as I know, pricked by the things that in time pricked John Kennedy's.
We also asked Mr. Revere if President Kennedy's influence on the civil rights issue will be felt after his death. Will President Johnson be as deeply committed?
I think Lyndon Johnson's commitment on this particular issue is as strong as the president's, and I cannot say, of course, we're all in all waiting to see how things shake down and out, but I would certainly not think that there'll be any less need, perceived, felt need in Washington, or any less vigilance.
Finally, How will history treat President Kennedy in terms of his civil rights role?
Let me put it this way. I think, and I think I wrote at the time, that Kennedy was the first American president, the first abolitionist president, the first truly abolitionist president in American history, in the sense that he came to the office with the conviction that any form of discrimination or segregation was morally and politically indefensible. I don't think any man before him, and certainly not Lincoln, went that far.
We also asked the Reverend Martin Luther King to evaluate the late president in terms of history.
I think historians will have to record that President Kennedy made one of the most significant contributions in civil rights of any president. He came forth with the most comprehensive civil rights bill that had ever been presented by any president since emancipation. He had the vision and the courage to face the crisis that developed in civil rights in the summer of 1963, and he met it with a positive program. I think this was a very significant step, and historians, I'm sure, will have to record it as such.
Martin Luther King is by no means alone. Frank McGee of NBC spoke to Roy Wilkins, the secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Might I ask you first, although I have seen in print what your reaction to the assassination of the president was, would you mind telling us what you feel to be the general temper and tone of the reaction of America's Negroes to the passing of the president?
Mr. McGee, they're shocked and grieved like everyone else. And I think probably especially so, because they regarded John Fitzgerald Kennedy as their friend, a friend of their cause. Not because he knew each one of them personally and wanted to do good for them, but because he believed in the democratic process and the protection of constitutional rights, and they thought he was on their side. They loved him. I think they evidenced that by the tremendous, overwhelming political support they gave him, more than 80% of their votes. And despite the fact that they may have had some differences and even some sharp criticisms in moments of great suffering and high emotion, that was not a turning from the president. It was just a differing with him. And like all Americans, they are saddened and grief-stricken today.
We will continue in a few moments with The Highest Price, the life and times of John F. Kennedy.
We now pause 10 seconds for station identification. WNBC, AM and FM, New York.
President Kennedy and his lady, our First Lady, were not stay-at-homes. They were very much the world travelers, before the presidency and during the presidency. They went, as the country's first family, wherever duty said they should go. Or rather, the president went because it was in our nation's best interest that he should go. And Jacqueline Kennedy went with him because no matter where they went, it was good for our country that she was there too. They went to many countries of Europe, to Mexico, to Canada, and to many countries of Latin America, even Venezuela, where a man named Nixon, then the Vice President of the United States, had been spat upon. And wherever the Kennedys went, either alone or together, the reception was very much like this one in Dublin.
And hundreds of the crowd have broken away from the police lines and are running down the opposite side of O'Connell Street, trying to keep pace with the President's motorcade, which is going about 5 miles an hour. Thousands of them have broken from the barricade, following the president as he goes down O'Connell Street. He'll cross the river up the other side and out to Phoenix Park, the beautiful park where the American ambassador's residence is. President Kennedy receiving a tumultuous welcome in Ireland.
And from Dublin, the president went to Rome, where he was received by Pope Paul VI. The time, July 1963, 4.5 months ago, and shortly after the death of Pope John the 23rd.
We extend to you a heartfelt welcome, and through Your Excellency, we wish to send our greetings to Mrs. Kennedy, to your family, and to all the citizens of your country, invoking upon them the abundant blessings of God.
Yes, the President and his lady were received everywhere, from the Vatican and into the world of art and literature, into the very inner circles of culture. Culture meant much to them, and through them, it was coming to mean much more to America than it ever did before. Mrs. Kennedy made over the White House so that it would better preserve the heritage that is our nation. Together, the President and Mrs. Kennedy strove to put culture on a level with everything else American: commerce, industry, banking, and the trades. And one of those whom the President called in to help was August Hexter, author, journalist, and director of the 20th Century Fund. Mr. Hexter recalls his meetings in the White House.
I received a letter from the President in January or February of 1962, asking me, quite out of the blue, whether I would come down to be on the White House staff as a special consultant or advisor to the President in the field of the arts. Mr. Kennedy, in this letter, said, obviously government can't do everything where the arts are concerned. It can't even perhaps do very much. I'm quoting, of course, only from memory. But I want to be sure that those things which government can do in this field are done well. And in one sense, that was the keystone and the spirit in which everything that I saw him do was marked by. He did care greatly about excellence. The President was terribly anxious to see that in all fields, great fields and those which might seem to be of less immediate or urgent necessities, that whatever the government did, it did with a touch of excellence and dignity and with a kind of glory. It seems to me that in recent years, we've forgotten that around the White House and around the government itself, from the center and out into the communities, there always should be this touch of great distinction. This, after all, the government and all that involves it, is the symbol of our freedom and the symbol of our strength. The post office in our city, even the post box on the corner, should in some way remind us of what government stands for. And the President was very aware and concerned with all that. He wanted government itself to be distinguished. But more than that, he felt, and he had felt from the beginning of his administration, that the artists, the intellectuals, the men of spiritual capacities in our society weren't on the outskirts, queer folk who somehow had to be accommodated or tolerated, but they were really at the very center of our national life. That they were one of the major elements in our strength and in our fame as a people. He had asked down to his inauguration representatives from all the leading fields of the arts and the intellect. They had come to Washington on that cold, dreary day in January 1961, this troop of representatives of the arts. And that simple gesture and their simple coming seemed to indicate that there was to be a new relationship in this country between the sphere of the intellect and the sphere of government. I've often been asked whether the President really was concerned himself with the arts, or whether he felt simply inclined to support and encourage them as part of a big national movement. People have said to me, the President is a very practical man. He's a politician, and he certainly was a politician, as every president has to be. They've said perhaps there was nothing in his past life which signified this interest in the arts. Was he really interested, or was it Mrs. Kennedy, whose concern in this field was the primary force? Well, I think I saw enough of the President in the year and a half that I was in the White House to feel that he had a deep interest in the arts, but it wasn't something that came to him from love of the opera or the ballet or music itself. It was rather a respect for things of the mind. He was himself a writer. He cared greatly about clear thoughts and clean style in everything that he said and wrote. And he came in this way, through a familiarity with historians and writers, to have a feeling of respect for artists in all fields. I remember once when he was talking with some young people on the lawn of the White House, he said to them, "You know, it takes just as much hard work to play a musical instrument well or to compose a symphony as it does to play baseball or to engage in any kind of sport." And it was that sense of discipline and hard work which led him into this search for excellence and then into a real concern for the flowering of the arts in all fields. And when you think of it, that isn't a secondary or unimportant way to appreciate the arts. We speak always of a work of art and the work that is in it, the toil of the hand and the toil of the spirit, seems to be one of the things which sets the great accomplishment apart from time and apart from the flux of change. And the president, having this deep sense of the importance of doing a thing well, a feeling for the work that went into great accomplishments, honored and respected the poets, the composers, the writers, the painters, the sculptors, the architects in our society. I may say the president cared also very much about what you might call the environment in which the citizens of a democracy live and carry on their work. He had something of the sense of the classic Greeks, that we are as citizens made what we are in part by our surroundings, that we are moved insensibly day by day to an understanding of the greatness of our destiny and the importance of our task by the beauty and the fitness of our physical surroundings. And so he did try very hard during his brief years to leave Washington, the capital city of the nation, a more beautiful place than it had been. He was deeply concerned with Lafayette Park, which lies just to the north of the White House, that this should not become a wholly modernized, efficient-looking area, but that it should preserve some sense of our history and some sense of our cultural development. He wanted the great stretch of Pennsylvania Avenue, which runs between the White House and the Capitol, to become a sort of civic center for the whole nation, a place where the great parades, the great festivals, great moments like inaugurals and great and tragic moments, alas, like that which we are witnessing in these days, that the thoughts of the nation should turn to this center, to this street, to these buildings, and that it would come to symbolize something important to the heart and the life of the nation. He cared also very much about seeing built, and I hope that in the months and years ahead we will surely see built the what is called the National Cultural Center in Washington. It is really a center for the performing arts.
Mr. Hexter, what else do you recollect of President Kennedy?
In these years, year and a half, I saw the president not as often, of course, as those who were dealing with him with the day-to-day work of the government. But one could never see him without being impressed by his courtesy, an instinctive sort of courtesy, by the quickness of his mind, by his wonderful ability to come to decisions, not snap decisions, but to see the thing that needed to be done, and when all the staff work had been done, to reach a clear conclusion. The last time I actually saw him was in this summer, when I submitted to him my resignation, my work having been done, as we had defined it when I first took it over. And I brought my 13-year-old boy with me. I thought we were just going to shake hands with the president and have a picture of that goodbye. But the president wanted to talk that day, and bringing my young boy into the office with me, he reviewed, as he often liked to do, a whole areas of the current scene. He talked about politics, about the Republican Party. He knew that I, in the past, had been connected with the Republican Party. He talked about events abroad, and, of course, he talked about his hopes for the richer and deeper development in the life of the arts in our own country. Toward the end of that, it was nearly an hour, it was certainly three-quarters of an hour, he turned and had my little boy, my young son, had been sitting there quietly through it all, I may say, his eyes open and his ears taking in everything that passed. He and the president had some words, largely about a small gift, actually, a pen or a P.T. Boat tie clip, which the president was giving him. When my boy wrote up the events of that momentous day in his diary, there's one sentence that has come back to me now. My boy said, all this, his conversation with the president, all this the president did not with an air of talking down to me, but with a feeling of friendly efficiency. And that feeling of friendly efficiency was something one felt throughout the White House, and certainly in that room where the president himself had his office. It was sad beyond measure in the White House yesterday, of course, passing by the flag-draped coffin of the president in the White House. But almost more sad, in a way, was to pass by the office of the president, that beautiful oval room looking out on the White House, and to find that there had been taken from there everything that was personal to him, the sofas by the fireplace, the rocking chair in which he had sat, that there was nothing left at that moment prior to the new president's coming in but the desk, the great desk itself, and the rug. And when my mind went back to times when that room had seemed to echo in every detail of its decoration and furnishings, in the mementos around and the pictures on the wall, it seemed to reflect the president's own personality so sharply. But all that was gone, and of course much else was gone also from the nation's life.
Yes, John Fitzgerald Kennedy is gone from our nation's life. Gone, but by no means forgotten, and certainly not in the world of culture and the arts. Listen to Henry Steele Cominger, author, professor, and historian.
He was, I think, more than any president since Jefferson, or John Quincy Adams, perhaps, aware of the role of art and science, and aware of the potentialities of an alliance of government with the arts and the sciences. He had seen what could be achieved by an alliance between government and science and government and education. And he was moving even now, in the last months of his life, toward a far livelier and more meaningful participation of government in the creative arts. The appointment first of Mr. Heckscher, the appointment of citizens' committees, the readiness to make available government resources, financial and otherwise, to the advancement of the arts. All of this was something new in our history in recent years.
Still, no matter what the 35th president contributed to literature and the arts, there are some who will say that John F. Kennedy did nothing while in the White House. But there are far more who will say, and history will certainly say, that President Kennedy did as much as any mortal man can possibly do for mankind when he brought about the world's first nuclear test ban treaty. A treaty, true, that is not the be-all, nor is it the end-all. But it was the first, it is the first. And without the first, there can be no second. Hear the President of the United States as he tells of mankind's first nuclear test ban treaty on the 26th day of the July just gone by, still not ratified but agreed to by the heads of the world's three nuclear bomb nations, England, Russia, and the United States.
Now, for the first time in many years, the path of peace may be open. No one can be certain what the future will bring. No one can say whether the time has come for an easing of the struggle, but history and our own conscience will judge us harshly if we do not now make every effort to test our hopes by action.
and this is the place to begin. According to the ancient Chinese proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles must begin with a single step. My fellow Americans, let us take that first step. Let us, if we can, step back from the shadows of war and seek out the way of peace. And if that journey is 1,000 miles or even more, let history record that we, in this land, at this time, took the first step.
And now hear the 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, on the ratification of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty by the Senate of the United States.
In its first two decades, the age of nuclear energy has been full of fear, yet never empty of hope. Today, the fear is a little less and the hope a little greater. What the future will bring, no one of us can know. This first fruit of hope may or may not be followed by larger harvests. Even this limited treaty, great as it is with promise, can survive only if it has from others the determined support in letter and in spirit, which I hereby pledge on behalf of the United States. If this treaty fails, it will not be our doing. And even if it fails, we shall not regret that we have made this clear and honorable national commitment to the cause of man's survival. For under this treaty, we can and must still keep our vigil in defense of freedom. But this treaty need not fail. This small step toward safety can be followed by others, longer and less limited, if also harder in the taking. With our courage and understanding enlarged by this achievement, let us press onward in quest of man's essential desire for peace. As President of the United States, and with the advice and consent of the Senate, I now sign the instruments of ratification of this treaty.
We said a few minutes ago that President Kennedy had earned for himself a place in history because of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and because of his foreign policy accomplishments. That opinion, however, is not ours alone. We share it with many, particularly with the men who should know best, the historians of our time. Here again is Dr. Henry Steele Cominger, professor of history at Amherst College.
I think history, I hope at least, that history will date the beginning of the thaw in the Cold War, not just from the Kennedy administration, but from Mr. Kennedy's own active and calculated efforts to bring about such a thaw. He saw more clearly, perhaps, than others in high posts that the armament race and the nuclear race was leading into a blind alley, that the law of diminishing returns had set in on this race, and he and Khrushchev were able to bring about the first and, I suppose, the most important single step in the cessation of that arms race, the nuclear ban treaty.
And here is Dr. Eric Frederick Goldman, historian, writer, moderator of NBC-TV's Open Mind program, and Princeton University professor.
I've always been struck in the case of Mr. Kennedy by the fact that in foreign policy, he seems to me to represent a step forward beyond mere containment and mere coexistence. Kennedy seemed to me to represent the next stage in which you accept containment, accept coexistence, accept massive foreign aid, but try to go about it critically and to develop new and imaginative techniques within it. To me, the president had just started that policy, and I suspect that had he gone into a second term, we might have seen some very, very new, fresh, and imaginative techniques in the foreign field. What I sensed was a questioning of the whole simple thesis that merely by giving foreign aid to any country which seems to need it and which is opposing communism, we are achieving some good. There was a drive for sophisticating the thinking within that context, very much so, I think, with the administration.
The President, John F. Kennedy, was on a serious speaking tour when he was shot down on the day before yesterday, the 22nd of November, 1963, in Dallas, Texas. 4 days earlier, on November the 18th, he was in Florida to address business leaders. But he took time out at the Tampa airport to deliver himself of these frivolous remarks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've been making nonpartisan speeches all day, and I'm glad to come here as a Democrat and express my pleasure. If there are any Republicans here, this is a Democratic message that I'm about to give. I want to give them fair warning. Woodrow Wilson once said that a political party is of no use unless it's serving a great national purpose. I believe that the Democratic Party in this century has served a great national purpose here in the state of Florida, here in this county, and here in the United States.
From Florida, the president, his wife, and official party flew to San Antonio to start a final fateful trip to Texas. Among the newsmen traveling with Mr. Kennedy was NBC's Robert McNeil, who tells about that motorcade through the streets of Dallas shortly after noon on Friday, November 22nd.
The motorcade could not have started off in a gayer mood. The president had been in extremely good form all during the Texas tour up to that point, and his good humor was reflected in the press corps as they went with him. It was also reflected in Mrs. Kennedy, who had emerged with quite a new image during this tour. She, of course, had quite a name for being shy and retiring in politics. Her few appearances during the 1960 presidential campaign had not been repeated, and this was her first real emergence as a professional-seeming politician's wife, and she really seemed to enjoy the role. In Houston, in the hotel in Houston on Thursday evening, she delivered a short speech in Spanish to a crowd of Latin American Texans, and her delight in her opportunity to do this was very evident. Later, when she and the president went down in the elevator, I got into the elevator with the Secret Service men, which was next to them, and was right behind Mrs. Kennedy when she walked out through a very crowded lobby. Previously, she would have walked through very serenely, but having very little contact except with her eyes and her smile with the crowd around her. But on this occasion, she went over to the rope barrier behind which the very enthusiastic crowd was waiting, and she shook hands, moved over and shook hands with them very deliberately. After Houston, the president moved on to Fort Worth, and again he was in extremely good form. The morning of Friday, November 22nd, was rainy. It had been arranged that the president would go to a Chamber of Commerce breakfast, but such a large crowd gathered outside his hotel before the appointed time for the breakfast that and there was such a clamor that he arranged to go across the street, and he went out in the rain. He had a sheen of fitness and good humor about him. His eyes were sparkling. He looked very rested. As he came out into the rain, his hair, which is normally somewhat unruly, still looked slightly damp from having just newly combed it down. He bounced up onto the platform. He was cheered by the huge crowd which was waiting there in the rain. And he made a joke which delighted them. He said, "Mrs. Kennedy is not here because she is still arranging things. It takes her longer than it does us. That's because it's better looking. She's better looking than we are." The crowd just went into delirium with this. He bounced down off the platform. He went over and he shook every hand within reach all the way around the perimeter of the barriers. And the Secret Service men had an extremely difficult time keeping the hordes of people back from him. He went back to the hotel. He stopped. This was described as a non-political tour, but President Kennedy, who had politics in his blood, who delighted in his ability to win people on the stump, he stopped on the way back into the hotel, and there were four cowboys there, or cowboy people looking in cowboy dress on horsemen. They were actually deputy sheriffs of Fort Worth. And he went, he shook hands with each one on his horse. Then he went into the hotel. There were more cheers. And he went in to speak at the breakfast. His set speech at the breakfast was a strenuous defense of the TFX fighter plane contract, which has brought potential of much prosperity to the city of Fort Worth if the contract is fulfilled as planned. And he received a thunderous ovation when he made this defense of the contract. All the time the people on the platform had been introduced, there were Vice President Mrs. Johnson, the Governor of Texas, John Connally, and Mrs. Connally, various congressmen and their wives. Mrs. Kennedy was conspicuous by her absence. And as all the introductions went by one, everybody began wondering, where is Mrs. Kennedy? Well, it turned out, a few whispers went around, that Mrs. Kennedy was just outside the banquet room, standing like an actress in the wings, waiting with a Secret Service man on either side of her, waiting in a vivid pink suit, a suit that was later to become very famous, in a matching pillbox hat, her eyes sparkling almost with mischief. I went out and watched her standing there, and at the appointed moment, the chairman got up and introduced her. She walked a long way. It took her about almost a minute to walk through this cheering crowd and up onto the platform. It was a very calculated entrance. She delighted in it. The president delighted in it. The crowd did. And one had the feeling that what people had been saying, that Mrs. Kennedy was the president's secret weapon for 1964, that there was some truth in this. There was a White House official standing beside me. He described the entrance as tactical. The president made another joke about this, and this reinforced the impression that Mrs. Kennedy was going to be a very big part of the campaign in 1964. He said, 2 years ago when I was in Paris, I said that I was the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris. I feel like this now on this tour of Texas, and the audience greeted that with a delighted roar. So Friday began on a very gay note, a note of confidence. As they came out of the hotel to move off to the airport, and we waited there, the rain had stopped. A brilliant Texas sun came out. There was a vividly blue sky. There was a crispness in the air, and a crispness about the president and Mrs. Kennedy. I was reminded very much, thinking of what he had said about Paris, because I covered the Kennedys on that trip in Paris in May 1961, and I was reminded very much of the first day they arrived there, when they took the French capital by storm with their youth, their vitality, and the sort of etched lines of their personalities in that bright sunlit atmosphere. And it was like that as they set off for Fort Worth Airport. We got out there just a little bit ahead of them, the press. We got into the press plane, which was a Boeing jet, and settled down for the incredibly short 8-minute jet ride to Dallas, which is just over 30 miles away. Everybody was gay, in good humor. We were looking at the speech which the president had prepared to deliver in Dallas, which was a stern and very forcefully worded rebuke to people on the extreme right who had been feeding what the president called nonsense to the American people, and he appealed to the American people to stop listening to such nonsense, that words were not the things to go by in the menaces which faced this country. We landed in Dallas, we got out of our plane, and took our places just in front of the huge crowd there, just as the president's jet rolled up. They came out of the jet again with this almost aura of vividness about them. Their colors of their clothes seemed much brighter than they had before. This is a sort of after impression. But Mrs. Kennedy came down in that pink suit, and as she came to the bottom of the steps, she again reached out eagerly to greet people, whereas it wasn't so long before that she was quite shy about it. She was handed a bunch of deep red roses, blood red roses, if that's not the wrong word on this occasion, and held them against this pink suit. And she moved forward, shaking hands very eagerly with all the crowd, who were the official crowd who were there, then broke away from them, again deliberately, and went around shaking the hands of almost everyone within reach. And they went mad with excitement. Most of them were teenagers. And then they got into the open car to begin the drive through downtown Dallas. Now, we had been expecting trouble in Dallas. The police in this city, ever since UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson had been attacked and insulted on October 24th, when a member of an agitator spat on him and another one hit him over the head with a placard, we'd been expecting trouble because the police had. They had put on extraordinary precautions, bringing out one-third of the force, rounding up, in addition to what the Secret Service... normally did, all possible agitators and warning them. The Dallas authorities were jittery. They did, the name of their city had been besmirched by the Stevenson incident. They didn't want any repetition of this. They were thoroughly ashamed of that. They wanted this, above all, to go very smoothly. It's interesting to note that Ambassador Stevenson has said after his experience here, he first warned the president not to come to Dallas. A few days later, he changed his mind and thought that he'd had too extreme a reaction.
And so the story, as all stories of humans must, and so the story of John Fitzgerald Kennedy comes to an end. The story of the 35th President of the United States.
Oh, Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting, while follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But, oh, heart, 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 oh, the bleeding drops of red, where on the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead. Oh, Captain, my Captain, rise up and hear the bells. Rise up, for you the flag is hung, for you the bugle trills, for you bouquets and ribboned wreaths, for you the shores are crowding. For you they call, the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells. But I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead.
Now, like Abraham Lincoln, in whose memory Walt Whitman wrote that poem, John Fitzgerald Kennedy belongs to history. How will history treat him? He was aggressive and decisive, but all his aggression and decision went toward restraint. He restrained those who wanted to be more violent in the Cold War. And for nearly a year now, we have not lived with the fear of imminent war. He restrained those who wanted to be violent in the racial war at home. Here is historian Alan Nevins speaking on the president's use of restraint in the field of civil rights.
I think history will commend him for his realization of the fact that he had to tread a middle path between those who would yield nothing and those who would demand too much. He would have lost his battle had he taken his stand with either side.
At the very beginning of this look at the president, we heard a historian say the president was a fusion of two traditions. One of those was the intellectual tradition. His use of intellectuals in government is part of a fairly recent tradition, which historian Oscar Henlon tells us about.
The intellectuals began to get into government under Theodore Roosevelt. They were there under Woodrow Wilson. They were there under Herbert Hoover. And, of course, in the New Deal, the Brain Trust was a very important factor. So Kennedy wasn't really establishing an innovation by bringing down intellectuals. He recognized that there are great pools of ability in the university, ability which is especially necessary in our highly technical civilization, and he was ready to draw upon it. But in addition, as a person, he was attracted to intellectuals. I think in a way he was himself an intellectual, not only because he wrote books, but because he was interested in ideas and in their consequences. He liked to talk to people who knew, who were thoughtful. He was attracted by ideas, and this certainly was a factor that increased his reliance upon this kind of person.
The president's background and tradition was reflected in his public appearances at press conferences.
Kennedy was literate and verbal. He had an extraordinary memory for figures and for facts, and he was able to deal on that plane, on a sort of intellectual level, with the questions that came from the floor. On the other hand, he was not personally moved much by the kind of immediate personal rapport that such a man as FDR or Truman was. And so his conferences had a character that was really a reflection of his own personality.
Even by non-presidential standards, he was a good writer.
He was a good writer. I don't know that as a historian he would have ranked among the very highest level, but he was a good, competent, and honest writer, and that's a lot. And of course, he, more than most recent presidents, was concerned with the composition of his own speeches and was very verbal as a writer.
What were his liabilities? Where did he fall down as president? Mr. Kennedy, probably because he was aggressive and decisive, was deeply involved in every action taken by his administration. He was a participant as an athlete when he was young, as a writer of books who couldn't stand the passive role of being a newspaper reporter, as a legislator. But unfortunately, none of these early roles prepared him to be an administrator. Perhaps this was his failing. Perhaps this was where he fell short. Dr. Eric Goldman.
I think that Mr. Kennedy's strategies as an administrator was to be a bad administrator, which I suspect is the key to all vigorous presidents of a certain reform trend of mind. I've been impressed by the fact that in modern American history, it's the conservative who is the great administrator and who has very little policy to administer. It's the liberal who has lots of policies he wants carried out but doesn't bother much about administration. This is true of Franklin Roosevelt, let's say, as opposed to Thomas Dewey or as opposed to Herbert Hoover. I noted the other day that the president, shortly before his death, remarked kiddingly that he was going to have a hard time finding a publisher for his memoirs because Bundy and Schlesinger would be in there ahead of time writing them, but that he was the only man who really understood what had happened in his administration. And I think that's right. It was all so personal and, in a sense, so helter-skelter compared to the rather neat structure of an Eisenhower. I say none of this in criticism because from the context in which I'm putting these remarks, I'm very skeptical of great administrators myself.
President Kennedy will be remembered for a great many things, for his innovations in the field of foreign policy and reducing things like the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, trade expansion, for reducing the tensions of a Cold War which had become almost excruciatingly suspenseful, and for insisting that the word equality means exactly that. But there was something else, something not easily definable. Call it verve, call it élan, call it vitality. It was there. Sometimes it made the very atmosphere electric.
Mr. Kennedy made the executive office exciting. He made it glamorous. He brought back to it some of that excitement, some of that prestige that had been associated with it under Franklin Roosevelt particularly. with Kennedy's election and with the inauguration of the new administration, a stir of excitement went through the whole country. As you will remember, thousands and thousands of young people flocked to Washington to take part in the great adventure which opened up again before them, just as they had flocked to Washington in 1933 to take part in a great adventure. And by restoring significance and excitement to politics, and by enlisting the young of all ages, the young in spirit, the young in heart, the adventurous, the experimental, he added a new dimension to the politics of this particular generation.
The politics of this generation are stamped indelibly with the character of President Kennedy. Unfortunately, perhaps, the man best able to interpret that character is now gone. For it was the president himself who best knew his generation, who best understood what really went on during his all-too-short administration. Perhaps history will never be able to learn everything it needs to know in order to put him in his proper rank. Where will history rank Mr. Kennedy among presidents? It is probably too early to say, but we ask a couple of historians to speculate whether they would put him in the first rank among great presidents. Here is Gerald W. Johnson.
I would put President Kennedy unquestionably in the second rank, perhaps high up in the second rank. Kennedy cannot be evaluated at this moment. It's too early. But as I guess, I would allow him rank in the second division and pretty high rank at that.
Here is Henry Steele Cominger's answer.
President Kennedy brought a great deal to the presidency. He belonged very clearly in that category of strong presidents, whose previous representatives include Washington and Jackson and Polk, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Truman, rather than in the weaker or more retiring presidents. He believed that the president was and should be a national leader. He believed that the president was and had to be a party leader. He believed that it was up to the president to formulate policies and to win public approval for those policies.
The final judgment, perhaps, belongs to the man himself. For it was John Fitzgerald Kennedy who set his own goals in his inaugural speech on January 20th, 1961.
Now the trumpet summons us again. Not as a call to arms, though arms we need. Not as a call to battle, though embattled we are. But a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle year in and year out. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. A struggle against the common enemies of man. Tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what America will do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
And what is it like in Washington tonight? What was it like in the capital of the United States today? As people come from all over the world to pay final homage to President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, here is Ellie Abel of NBC News.
It took the violent death of America's president to bring together tonight here in Washington more crowned and uncrowned heads of nations than have ever assembled before in the United States. All afternoon and well into the night, their jets came screaming down to land at Dulles International Airport in suburban Virginia, came to join in this hour of national grief and shame with the American people. Most of them are silent. They feel, as President de Gaulle of France made clear on his arrival this afternoon, that they would consider it in poor taste to deliver statements. Their presence alone is an act of condolence, and they come from every continent, from the ancient centers of Europe and Asia and Africa and South America. A few did have something to say, and some of those words are worth reporting. The Prime Minister of Norway, for example, Einar Gerhardsen. I know a number of Norwegians, he said, who lost some of their closest family and didn't have a tear in their eyes. I saw these people weeping at the news of the death of President Kennedy. Nor is this show of grief limited to such staunch friends and allies as the Norwegians, the British, or the Italians. The Vice Premier of Poland, doubtless a good communist, made a point of telling reporters on his arrival that his visit was not just a diplomatic